obviously, you know, lighting candles in the basement for 600 years is a nice ritual, but for 500 years is a nice ritual, but how is it that we're going to now, as full-fledged members of the Jewish community, with a clear understanding of where our descent comes from, very standardized halakhos, firstly from the standpoint of marriage, and as well from the standpoint of conversion, that we're going to just start taking in thousands and thousands of people? What are the controls on the scenario, and how do you deal with each individual as he comes forward? So what I found was that there was quite a great deal of tumult about this in and around 10 years ago, starting around, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, and the two people who dealt with it, and I'll get to their tshuvas in a couple minutes, the two Gedolei Yisrael who dealt with it was on the Sephardic side, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and on the Ashkenazic side, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Both of them wrote tshuvas about this. And it's very surprising to see how they're writing, just knowing their personalities from, to see them dealing with this topic, which is so obscure. It's a big, big challenge. So before we get into that, I guess we can start with the background. The impetus for this year, when I first looked into it, was yeah?
Well, they had the same problem with the Yeshiva.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So there's a tshuva from Rav Avadja, which lumps the Anusim of Spain into the same categories as my family is actually from India. We're Iraqi Jews from India, but the quote-unquote real Indian Jews, the B'nai Menashe, the B'nai Israel, if you would have asked my grandfather if they were real Jews, he would have said they're not really Jewish. So there was also quite a deal, you can imagine, just that perspective, and that was the classic Iraqi perspective of, the Jews who moved from Iraq into Bombay and into Calcutta, that was their perspective. Well, Elijah puts them all together in one tshuva along with the Ethiopian Jews, and a couple of other different groups that he mentions all together, and comes to more or less the same conclusion, which is very different than those of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu and as well of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So, before we get to the actual halakhos, let's get a little bit of background on the situation. So firstly, like I was mentioning, the impetus for giving the shiur the first time was that it was just around Shavuos, and then now it's also just around Shavuos, and at the time was the very beginnings of internet dating. I don't know if folks have ever tried that. At the time it was a real Wild West. I now have at least three friends who have found their shidduchim on Jewish internet dating sites. Real JDate. The one that was the most popular at the time was Saw You at Sinai. And it comes from the Midrash, which is the idea was all Jews were present at Har Sinai, and you're going to go on that's like a mini Har Sinai. Everybody's going to show up back online, and then you're going to say, oh, I think I know you from somewhere, so on and so forth. As a way of, a cute name. Eventually, by the way, Saw You at Sinai was bought by JDate, which is now far and away the largest. JDate is actually a fantastic site, even for people who are every color of the orthodoxy rainbow.
But your wife knew your wife?
Yeah, she knew at the time. It was father-in-law's here.
I never got past
Krumstar. Okay. So the idea behind it, though, if you look at the Midrash, describes, and I just underlined, Elohan Shomo Shatidim Liboro Shalom Neam Arbahen Shavim Hayu Bechlal. Right? So this is all the different Neshamot of Am Yisrael that are ever going to exist were present in Har Sinai. So that makes sense for all the people who are going to be born, but what about the Ger? Right? And what about the people, so that's what this Midrash deals with, is that even the Ger is found at Har Sinai. The question is, what about the people who lose touch? Right. What about the people who were Jewish and then for whatever reason they lose touch? So maybe they are Jewish, maybe they're not Jewish. It's a big question. And the question is, were they really, in effect, were they also at Har Sinai? These people who 600 years later are still lighting, doing halakhos neros in their basement every Friday night, what's their status vis-a-vis the halakhos? So to give you a little bit of background, probably everybody's familiar with the famous date of 1492, in which the edict, the Alhambra decree, the edict of expulsion, was exacted upon the Jews of Spain. It's not exactly such a simple thing where Ferdinand and Isabella woke up one morning and they said, the Jews are really not so good for us, let's get rid of them. If you know the history a little bit, it really started about 100 years earlier. In 1391 was the first in a series of major pogroms that went all throughout what we today call Spain. At the time, it wasn't really Spain. It was different monarchies, the monarchy of Castile, all the way up north. And you'll know that there are all different, there are all different areas in which the Gedolei Yisrael lived. So, for example, the city of Toledo, the Rav of the city of Toledo in the early 1300s was the Rosh. The Rav of the city of Barcelona, all the way up north, was the Rashba. So you have real Gedolei Yisrael who are living in Spain all throughout the 1300s, and in 1391 you still have Gedolei Yisrael. The Gadol Shebnehem at the time was the Rivash, and he and his community were literally attacked and forcibly with sword to neck said, either you convert to Christendom or you're going to lose your life. And there were these type of, I don't know what the word is, I guess the word we use now is pogroms, but there were these type of forcible pogroms, these forced conversions that would happen all throughout the next 100 years before the edict, before the actual edict of expulsion. So if you take a step back, not from the Jewish perspective, but from the world perspective, throughout the Middle Ages, Christianity and Islam were at war over the land that we today call Spain. It started off that the whole thing was Islamic, except for the very north, which is the area connected to what we would call halakhically, I guess, you know, in halakhic terms, the Jews of Provence, so they were connected right to that area. So what happens is, over time, the Christians pour south, 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 and they eventually, by the 1300s, by the late 1300s, are able to reconquer all of Spain, what's called in academic circles the Reconquista. And once they reconquered all of Spain, so now their enemy was Islam, and now they have no one to fight with. So all of a sudden the Jews are in this very uncomfortable situation, and that's really when these pogroms begin. And one by one Jewish communities are very forcibly attacked, and what happens is, you've all heard the famous stories, Jews are committed to Christianity by the sword, and then what do? They live as secret Jews in hiding. And these secret Jews who are living in hiding, so this, it wasn't just like there was like a little group of secret Jews and everybody knew. This was, their lives were on the line. There were Inquisition. The Inquisition had already was well into place before it became a Jewish Inquisition. It was confined secret non-believers who were pretending to be Christians outright, and instead, privately, they were still maintaining Jewish ritual, Jewish customs. So if you look at the text of the actual decree of expulsion, you read it, it says, these Jews, meaning the secret Jews, the ones who are hiding, the Marauders, instruct these Christians in the ceremonies and observances of their law. Right? So you have the secret Jews talking to the Christians, trying to convince them, and as well, who are the Christians that they're referring to here? They're referring to Jews that have already converted to Christianity.
The new Christians.
The new Christians, exactly. So what happens? So now you've got basically three different Jewish communities. You've got the Jews who are still Jews, who haven't been attacked, who have for some reason been able to maintain their Jewish, their Jewishness. You have the secret Jews who are Christians in name only, and then you have the Jews who are Christians full-fledged, the ones who have converted the lay shalom. And that's where you have the challenge, because it's really a huge witch hunt of who are the real Jews, who are not the real Jews. You can imagine what type of community that must have been to live in, where you don't know who's your friend, you don't know who's your enemy. And the methods of torture are all, you can go read about them, but you know, once a Jew was found to be a Jew and not a new Christian, he was taken, tortured, and eventually he had to admit who all the other secret Jews were as well. So it became obviously a very challenging situation, and when a Jew was found out to be, no, not a Christian, but a Jew, what happened was called an auto de fe, which was they took him into the town square, and he was publicly humiliated and then publicly burned alive, which is, in Jewish history, one of the most terrible, one of the most terrible periods. In fact, the auto de fe for secret Jews actually continued long after the expulsion. The last one was in 1775 in Mexico City. Still, you know, the Inquisition is still going after Jews how many years later? Almost 300 years later. So you can see what the Jews, what type of world they were up against. What's even more fascinating about the Alhambra decree is that the people who put the shit up together between Ferdinand and Isabella were actually Jews. That was the joining of the Kingdom of Spain for the first time. The Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom of Spain finally come together. That was the people that made those shit up. The people who were their money lenders. And who are their money lenders? Two people. One of them's name was Abraham Senor, which probably not a lot of people have heard of, but he was really the number one Jew from the standpoint of state, and the number two guy was the Abarbanel. So the Abarbanel is watching all of this happen. He is the leader of the Jewish community while this is happening from both the rabbinic level and as well a very public level, a political level. And he leaves with the Jewish people. Senor ultimately is converted publicly in the town square as a symbol of all the Jews are either converting or leaving. And those are kind of, in academic circles, those are the two characters who are played one against the other, Senor and Abarbanel. So back to the halakhic standpoint. So now, the Jews in 1492 are expelled. They end up going to Portugal. By 1497, the Jews are kicked out of Portugal as well. And now, Jews are scattered all throughout the world, whether it's Holland, where many of them went, whether it's South America, whether it's Latin America, whether it's the different Sephardic countries like Iraq, Persia, all those areas. The Jews of Spain have now been scattered all throughout the world. And what's even more important is the secret Jews of Spain have now been scattered all throughout the world, but they're still worried about being found. So what do you do from a halakhic standpoint with all the different cases that can arise? The Rivash is going to deal with one of those cases very delicately, just to look back to our case. So what to do in 2007, 2010, 2011, if my father-in-law ever has the exclusive of having a nice Latino kid come in and tell him that he's a Murano, probably these types of things don't happen in Chile. Florida, it's like, it's close enough to, it's close to Cuba. There's a lot of different things going on in Florida. Phoenix, you get somebody, it's different, there are different stories in Phoenix. In Florida, this was the type of crowd that you get.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
When the Jews were expelled, why did those who maintained their yadus in secrecy, why did they not at that point say, all right, we're out of Spain, we can then...
That's what the Rivash deals with, and the Rashbash also deals with.
But historically, what happened with those people?
So many of them turned around and said, I'm Jewish again, and that presented one set of halakha problems.
Okay.
Many of them went to places in which the Inquisition was still chasing after.
Okay.
If the land was owned by Spain, it was still under the Inquisition's hand. If it was owned by Portugal, it was still under the Inquisition's hand. So you still had many, many Jews many years later, and just emotionally, I mean, you can imagine emotionally what it's like where your family has been hiding as Jews for 100 years. Just think about the last 100 years of American Jewry, what type of emotion, a family passes down. So now imagine that now being 120 years, you've been living as a secret Jew, and you leave. You don't know anything else.
Did they try to maintain marriage among their own?
You'll see very interestingly that one specific group of Jews tried very hard, and that was the Kohanim. And you'll see how that plays out. One of the ways in which this has come to light is through DNA studies.
Okay.
So I'll show you an article at the end in which that plays out. In general, the answer is yes, but how much can you try? I mean, it's nice to say we're secret Jews, but your kids are still going to public schools. They're going to church every week. You're going to meet nice girls. The Christian girls are just as pretty as the Jewish girls, you presume, in Middle Eastern Spain. What happens? Intermarriage happens. From a yichus standpoint, it's easy to talk about, but it's much harder.
They couldn't make it.
And you have to think about commitment. I mean, we're assuming everybody really wants to be a Jew. Probably, if you told all the American Jews right now, you all have to be Christian, probably there'd be some people who'd be interested in knowing what ham tastes like, right? So, think about it from an emotional point, from a psychological point, and after doing that for 150 years, where does somebody sit? So it's easy to say, of course they're going to go back and be Jews. And many of them did. But many of them maintained what had been passed down to them already for four or five generations.
What was that date again for the last article, say, in Mexico City?
1775. Okay. Yeah, if you want to read more about, there's a couple of books, probably the guys to read, actually Bibi Netanyahu's brother, or his cousin. Not his father, Benjamin, what's his name?
His father is a scholar.
He's written a lot about the Inquisition. His father.
Yeah, so then it's his father. And then the other guy is...
What?
One of Bibi's political control.
I think he also has an uncle who wrote specifically about what happened after he was left. You're probably right. There's a number of historians who have wrote about what happened to the Jews. The guy who had written a book, Bernard Gampel, also, who's a professor of JPS, wrote a book about what happened to the Jews after they were expelled from Portugal. So that's really, really interesting. I haven't read the whole thing, but I took a class of this, so I have to read a bunch of chapters. That's probably the best place to look at what happened afterward. Okay, so just first off, what happens broadly from a halakhic perspective when somebody leaves Yadut for whatever reason. So we'll just look at the words of two of the greatest halakhic disciples, Rashi and the Rambam. So Rashi's supposed to crusade, what to do with people who have been forcibly converted in the crusade and then come back. So the question that's here, you'll read the question from Rashi. Right? The following is what's discussed. writes like this. Al davar kedushei ha'olam, ashi katsha l'shnayim, u'shneim hayu anusim, lav or al toras moshe al yidei koyim, v'gam ha'edim kayotze v'hem hayu. So it's talking about a marriage case where what you're dealing with is people who have been, for whatever reason, presumably here we're talking about the Crusades, Rashi writing this tshuva following the first crusade, writing about what happens, people who have been forcibly converted. First off, their marriage is the Kedushin Tosin. Can you have a marriage with those type of people? And second of all, from the standpoint of Edus, the Edus in that case, should it be real Edus, right? Could there be a bigger soul for Edus than Christianity, than forcible conversion? So Rashi writes, Roa Ami, she tzrich get. This woman would require a get. So obviously it means the Kedushin or Tosin. And as well it means that the Avis at some level was valid. She'af Yisrael Meshumat L'Ritzono, Shekidesh, Kedusha Kedusha. Even a Jew who leaves the fold, and he is L'Ritzono here, Meshumat L'Ritzono, somebody who goes willingly, Shenamar, Chata Yisrael, even though Yisrael is with Chote, he's still Yisrael. The culture came, Anusim, Shalibam Lashamayim. Rashi writes, but especially the Anusim, the ones who are forcibly converted, Libam Lashamayim. Bahari Elu, Mochia Sofan, Afkilat, and Shechodri, Yatsu Misham, Kishemotsu Hatsala. What's going to happen, like you mentioned, after the first crusade, the Christians leave, and that was not a situation where it's passed down generation to generation to generation. It was one small time period. The Jews then, it's the same people who go back and say, you know, that was what I did publicly, but now privately, I'm a very different person. That's what I did privately. Now publicly, they're going to go back and rejoin the fold. So Rashi writes, that would be a situation in which the woman would require a get. Obviously, there's a much broader halakhic question, but you see the words of Rashi form a basis, like a kind of a takeoff point for much of what we'll see. And if you look, the Rambam echoes the same thing. He's talking here about the Karaites. Which is where the Rambam lived. This was a major issue, that there were real Karaim, were people who, traditionally we say Karaites are people who don't believe in the Torah Sheva Alpeh. In truth, it was people who had created their own Torah Sheva Alpeh based on a more textual reading. Well, here's what the Rambam writes, about B'nei Hatom Ha'elim, B'nei. After writing about how the Karaites are awful people, so on and so forth, what about their children? What about the B'nei Hatom? The sons of the ones who have made mistakes. They're forced in by their parents. These are people who are literally born amongst the Karaites. What's happening? These are people that have been brought up with Tot. Classic Kinoshenishba. So what does the Rambam write? He writes there are 100% Jews in effect. However, what do? We have to go out with Chesed, extend our arm, and bring them back. This is also, by the way, the basis of a lot of, you know, somebody who's going to be doing a lot of Kiruv. So the question is, how do you approach somebody who's grown up either in America or in Israel, in a totally non-connectful society, who's grown up with parents who have not given him a Jewish education, who haven't given him any semblance of Torah, of the Torah. What do? Mashkam b'chesed. You reach out your hand, you bring them back with chesed. Why? Because just like you have standing in the Jewish people, they have the same exact standing. So that's the backdrop of how the Gedolei Yisrael deal with this problem. But now let's get into the actual halakhic issues. And you look at the tshuva of the Rivash.
Yeah. Well, it's not clear to me from Rambam. Is he dealing with the Lifersha objective, Shiloh? What's the emotional status with regard to the community? Do these people want to be Jews? Are they regarded as bums?
So that's exactly the question. What the Rambam writes, and you see all throughout history, is emotionally, the second they take the first step, you welcome in as wholeheartedly as possible. You teach them whatever you can.
And that implies there was such a desire from the... on the part of the...
Historically, I don't know.
That's a really amazing...
Yeah. It seems it says Eno Zoris. It says that they're not going to... I'm saying, think about it. The best context I can think about it in...
But Eno Zoris can mean... I'm trying to differentiate between... I have no identity as a Jew, which case, I don't know why he's talking about this.
Lishita Sum, they're observing what they think they're supposed to observe.
Yeah. So you see the challenge that the Rambam's
giving. That's what I'm saying. He's talking about somebody who thinks he's Jewish even though he's not Tofes anything.
So I'm saying, think about it, somebody who grows up in like Reform and thinks that that's the way, you know, I'm not saying what isn't,
but the guy thinks he's Jewish and wants to be Jewish.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I got.
It seems like that's what the Rambam's writing about. Otherwise, what, like, where do you even take off from?
Yeah, or why go away or why go away?
It wouldn't be like an Eino Zaris. It would be, like, that would be the wrong language if it's anything else, no?
Yeah.
It seems like it. I don't know. I mean, you have to imagine that amongst the Karaites, not everybody grew up like, oh, this is the perfect way. Probably some of the people were like, maybe I should be doing things the way it was passed down. I don't know, though. Historically, I don't know. Okay, so let's move on to the tshuva of the Rivash. The Rivash was the head, probably the most notable amongst the Gedolei Yisrael, living in Spain at the time when the Rambam first broke out in the 1390s. He's writing here, the tshuva is from the first decade of the 1400s. He's writing already from North Africa. The Rivash was managed to maneuver his way out of Spain. There's some... The Rivash is probably the most fascinating of all the Rishonim who there isn't a lot written on. Maybe there is, and I haven't seen it, but there's not a lot that I found written on the Rivash. He was at a time of real upheaval. He was also, on a personal level, very, very much a part of the pogroms. He was actually following that pogrom in 1391, accused very publicly of a sexual impropriety, and he was forcibly removed from the head of the Jewish community. There's a lot of unclarity as to what happened in that situation with the Rivash. Eventually, he leaves Spain and manages to find himself in North Africa. There was, in the 1990s, one of the Spanish historians was going through, the guy's name is Riera, he was going through all of the historical, the royal documents, and what he came upon was the story of a Jewish notable who, following the first pogroms in the 1390s, was forcibly taken into the streets, dressed up like a priest, and marched throughout the community, who said that he was the Rivash. That's what Riera's assertion was. Jewish historians very much are not, obviously they're not comfortable with that because it's the Rivash. And second of all, because they say that, you know, if you look at the documents, I don't even speak Spanish to be able to do that, but looking at the documents, they said it's not possible to say that the Rivash was really that guy based on the fact that chances are he was already in North Africa. But very definitely, he was right at the center of the first series of pogroms. He personally went through great trauma, and there's about 10 years of his life in which nobody sees anything written from the Rivash. There's kind of like an empty space in his tshuvas, if you look at it from a dating perspective. Before he leaves Spain, until he gets to North Africa, the question is whether or not he spent some time in jail in Spain. Nobody really knows what happened to the Rivash, but here already he's writing about the Anusim. So with that backdrop, you would think he'd be overly sensitive to the Anusim. Right? Somebody who's been in the middle, he's seen his own community, what's happened, swords to necks, you'd think he'd be very sensitive, so in the classic Rivash fashion, he's not at all. And if you read the tshuva, you'll see. He says, "Lachem ba'elu ha'anusim sha'avar alayhem chera hashmad, ba'amdu yamim rabim, bein obdei kochavim, gozre hashmad, lo maltu nafsham el eretz acheret, yavdu Hashem b'li pachad." So he's talking about Jews who were involved in the Shmad, they were involved in these Gezeros, 1391, and still, unlike the Rivash himself, who somehow managed to make it to North Africa, have not managed to make it out of these lands. So he's talking still about Moranos. Roy Lachkor Arbe Be'inyanam. You have to be very careful when dealing with their names. Ki yesh mehem shahayi yichol b'yadam latzei min ha'aretz ahi, ulamalei nafsham min ha'shmad. There are some people who really had the opportunity to leave. And they didn't take the opportunity. Imagine, if you were told you have to leave, so what do you think about? It's simple, right? Obviously I'm going to leave. You can't be Jewish here, you leave. You have the opportunity. But then you have to think about it. There's your grandmother who's still in a home, and you can't leave without her. You've got little kids, you've got a parnasa, you've got a business, you've got a piece of real estate. It's not so simple. You're given the chance to leave, or you're given the chance to live secretly as Jews amongst the majority of your community. It's not a simple thing to just get up and go to a place where you can, you know, to a place where you can go and live openly as a Jew. So this is what the Rivash is getting at. He says, "Elu Ela Me'achar Shehimiru Af Im Chilasam Ba'Onis." Right? What happens? Chilasam is Onis. Achar Kaf Parku Ola Shemayim Nifku Mosro Hatorah Me'Alehem Mirzonam Holchim V'Chukot Ovdei Kochavim. There are some people, this is the first category, it says there are some people Correct. Chilas of Ba'onis. But what happens eventually? Ham is not so, it tastes pretty good. And it's not so bad to sit in church on Sunday morning for an hour instead of sitting in shul on Shabbos morning. Certainly I don't want to have to do both. Once I've already got to do one, why am I going to get myself involved in the other? You can imagine. This is...
Can't believe it, the robber, man.
Just I'm saying, try to put yourself into those shoes. It's easy to think about it in a historical context, but while you're living in it, what the Rivash is writing very sternly is that many of the people just become out-and-out Christians. What do? Then they become the tattletales. They become the witch hunters, and they find the secret Jews. Very strong words. Then there are other people who are out and out Jews. They want to be Jewish as much as possible. They want to leave, however, they have a grandmother and they're waiting for her. There's no way she can leave them. What, they're going to leave her? They have little babies. They have a kid who's in school. It's not such a simple thing to move your whole family out of the place it's been for 300 years. And maybe even they can get themselves out. What's going to happen? The Baal Bayit says, I can leave. But kids who are here and they're in college already, well, all these different factors are playing, and then they're going to say, correct, I can leave with my family, but what about the whole family? If I leave, they're gone forever. So I'm staying here to kind of hold down the ship. It's a tremendous thing to think about. So let's Vehen Bochum Lihidakiv Sham, Laman Havia Pre Beitam, Vehebel Rasan Atar Mitzvotel. Let's just skip to the last piece. In the interest of time, Vadavar Parur, Shalom Hitzal Aegis, Elamisha who Mezu Gamor, Bahavera Shechayavim Alam Malkus, Kamosha Katov Mal. What's the ultimate halakhic position of the Rivash? The ultimate halakhic position is, how do you judge someone? Ultimately, he says, anybody who's done something openly that he would be chayav malchut for, b'mezid. How do you define that b'mezid? Right? So the Rivash is answering his shaila, and he's saying, how do you figure out if somebody properly had edus at their wedding that would require a get afterward? He says, somebody who's done something b'mezid. So does the Rivash really answer anything for us? At a certain level, yes. He paints a historical picture, creates something that's very murky. But on the other hand, he says, so how am I going to solve it? Anyone who's been over an avera that's chayav malchus, b'mezid. How do you define who's b'mezid in this type of situation? Creates a very, very difficult situation. What ultimately happens, la halacha, is case by case, these cases are decided. This is in the 1400s. What about 100 years later? So Rabbi Yosef Caro, writing Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Caro actually was born in Spain. He left when he was 4 years old in the expulsion in 1492. It's quoting from a tshuva of the Rosh Bash. The Rosh Bash was the son of the Tashbetz, who was probably the biggest Baal Machlokas with the Rivash. Tashbetz writes very angrily against the Rivash. Of note, he never writes that the Rivash was forcibly converted. He also never writes anything about the Rivash's personal trials and travails. But very aggressively, they attack each other from a halakhic standpoint. If you read in the Beis Yosef, he's writing exactly about this situation. V'chein katav harash ben harashbats, the tshuva, kol she, and I have the tshuva here if you want to see it afterward, it's very long, kol she imam Yisrael, let's say somebody, what do you do in these situations? Kol she imam Yisrael, somebody whose mother is from Yisrael, afilu mikama doro, even after a couple generations, afilu goy haba'al hamishumata, even if it's a goy who comes upon the mother, meaning that the father is not Jewish, Zera haben hu Yisrael afilu at sof ha'olam. How do you deal with the situation? Same way we would now. Zera haben hu Yisrael afilu at sof ha'olam. He remains Jewish afilu at sof ha'olam. Ve'ein lahem din geirim kla. There's no geirish whatsoever for them. Ve'ein lanu lahafilam ulaharchida ulaharchidam kishevon lachzor v'tshuva. Ve'ein sarach lahodiyam tzad mitzvos kalos v'chamuros. And he starts to go through the different pieces of geirish. None of geirish applies to these people. They have the same exact view of the mitzvahs. They were there with us at Har Sinai. They were there sitting right next to you at Har Sinai. They don't require tefillah. They don't require anything for gerus. the same exact way as you would, which is different for a ger. And the Rama writes a little bit differently, following up this discussion. So you see, Shulchan Aruch writes, there's no requirement for tefillah whatsoever. And the Rama writes, there is a requirement of tefillah d'rabbanan. The Kabbalah of Dibre Chaveros, which is named Gimel, so on and so forth, he has to actually accept the mitzvah back. So now, you have at least two opinions. As you turn over, we'll see what to do with it. Now, instead of getting into a whole Yisroel, no more discussion of what to do from a Gerus perspective there after a number of generations, we'll stick locally to the case of the Spanish Jews. But you have at least two halachic positions. One of them is you can trace back that the mother is Jewish. Mother after mother after mother is Jewish. They're Jewish. There's no discussion to be had. There's nothing to discuss. According to the Rama, if you're in that situation, it makes sense to do what's called Tvila Durabana. Tvila Durabana, obviously not a simple thing. We're not going to get into a whole discussion of that until we see it in here, in the modern day Tshuvas. But Tvila Durabana, something that says he's Jewish, but he's still going to do the Tvila. And he's going to have to still accept the mitzvahs. What? In front of a basin. So now the question is, what happens 500 years later with the Anusim? So if you look at the two tshuvas that are here, first we can read from Rav Aharon Soloveitchik. He writes the following. This is an incredible tshuva. I'm taking the liberty to write about the people in the Americas who claim to be descendants of the Muranos of Spain and Portugal. By the way, the word Murano is a very interesting word. In Hebrew, like we all think Murano. Anybody know where it comes from?
In Spanish.
Yeah, so that's one of them, Spanish for pigs. It's also Arabic for like nameless, faceless, like a ma'aran. And then in Hebrew, maranos also is alludes to the word mar anus, somebody who's been, and then also alludes to the concept of mar sain. So there's a lot there in that word. It's probably the most loaded word. So if you call the marano, basically you're being outly and openly called swine. You're also being called at the same time, as far as you're concerned, somebody who's forced into that role. A very powerful word. I personally would not want to be called that, even if it was my heritage. So the Rav Aharon Soloveitchik writes, they must be treated like full Jews in every way, counted for minyan, given aliyah. However, only when one of these anusim wishes to marry a Jew, must he or she undergo a full conversion. That is, he or she must undergo immersion in a mikvah without a blessing, full acceptance of the mitzvah or commitment to Torah. A man, if he's uncircumcised, must in addition undergo circumcision. If he's already circumcised, then he has to do hatafas dam bris. Hoping that this will clarify the solution to this problem, I remain respectfully yours. This is a very powerful tshuva. So, who does he side like?
He's out from Mother Ramah.
Right. You'd like to think that he would have at least given you the position of the Rama, which is Tila de Ramana, right? So it could be that what the Rama is dealing with, though, is someone when you know their mother, generation to generation, generation to generation, you can track the mother. What's the situation here? You're dealing 500 years later. It's impossible to establish that 500 years worth of mothers are all Jewish. Right? I don't know. Agreed. It doesn't seem... Usually... If you're going to be a modern-day posek, you're going to either take one position, take another position, and you'll follow that position through. What Rav Aharon Soloveitchik is doing is giving a little bit more strength to it, because in truth, it's impossible. I don't know, maybe there's a guy who could figure it out, but I don't think any Jew, any rabbi these days is equipped to be able to go back 500 years worth of Mesorah to be able to track this one's mother, this one's mother, this one's mother, especially when it's people living in hiding. So... it's a big question. So then what was drawn up, this is in the state of Israel, drawn up is a certificate of return. Actually, we'll do the next source first, and then we'll look at the certificate of the return. But this is from Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. He's answering the same exact question. And you'll note that he has a little bit of a different take than Rav Soloveitchik. Right? So he writes there, it's been quite a bit of time from the time of the Anusim until today. There's a chashash of taroves. I'd say it's probably more than just a chashash. It's hard to figure out the yichus of the anusim. So that's what we just That's not what we read. Reish Samachet, Hilchos Gerim, writes what you do for a ger. Ukaloshon Harash Bash, that's what is quoted by Beis Yosef, Simon Samachet, Amu Beis Yosef, so on and so forth. Yesh Lamosh Kho Chesed. You pull him back with Chesed. So that's, what's he doing? He's taking the words of the Rashbash, and instead of taking the words of the Rashbash from a halakhic standpoint, he said, really the halakha is, you're supposed to give them everything that a ger requires. They require Mila, Tvila, and Kabbalah HaMitzvos. However, Yesh Lamosh Kho Chesed. Treat them with Chesed. Do it in the proper way. Behind Yesh Yesh Lashavcham Haban Hayom Lachaymet Kho Mitzvot HaTorah V'Giloy. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to give them Shevach. You're supposed to welcome them back with open arms. Veshuv ayin shel shavakar ha-pritcha osim lo mavarkim lo tov ha-omrim. And what do we have here? He actually writes a tefillah for the people who return. Elokeinu v'elokeinu ha-tzlachna ha-tzloni ha-nikra shmo ka'at. And you give him a Jewish name. U'moshoche la-tzeset, exactly the words from the Rashbash. U'keshem she-atita libo la-shuv v'tshuva shlemo l'fanecha. Kach kita v'libo ahavatcha v'yorakcha v'tiktach libo v'torakcha v'tadricheo v'tiv mitzvotecha l'man yimasa chen v'enecha ken yiratzom v'nomar. Beautiful, a beautiful tefillah, which you have the English down here on the bottom, the translation of this tshuva. Right? It's a beautiful tefillah, but what's the bottom line?
He's no different than Rav Aaron.
Right? What's the bottom line? The bottom line is, la'afr sha'avr et kol ha'alichim sha'alim v'torah v'kabalas torah v'ol mitzvos, the only difference is Yesh Lotelo to Udas im ha koteres to Udas Shav Ladarche Avosa. You give him a to Udas Shav. You don't give him, he's not a real gear, he's a Shav. We've got to go through all the steps, you have to make sure there's a real Kabbalah Samitzos, but you don't call him a quote unquote gear. Now what would the obvious not be mean as big? Exactly. The obvious nafkaminas are going to be, if they're not really a ger, all the different aspects of halacha that applies to gerim would not apply to them. So this is the next step of the halacha. Would you let this person marry a kohen? And it seems, from what Mordechai Eliyahu was writing here, or wrote here, that certainly they would be able to marry a kohen. And that would be the practical difference. But for the individual, when he or she shows up at my father-in-law's office to say I want to come back to the minyan and be part of the Jewish people, practically each and every step should go the same way. Why? Because after 500 years, it's very hard to establish someone's yichus.
Yeah. Here he's addressing, though, someone who is coming, l'kiyum es kol mitzvot ha-Torah b'gilui, someone who wants to become a fully observant Jew.
Yeah.
What about someone who comes up and says, I want to be able to come into shul, I want to be able to daven for the Omer, get an aliyah, but I have no becoming, a Ben Torah, being Shomer Tayag Mitzvot.
So presumably, you'd have to ask a real live rabbi what to do in that situation.
Okay.
But presumably, according to both the
report, someone wants to become from, it's not such a big deal. The only difference being whether they can marry a
Kohen. That's the thing. That's the catch-22, is that if somebody wants to become from, he's going to say, well, the Chumrah, obviously I should be going through all these steps, right? So the case I had was a guy who, B'lei Shalem, really wanted to become from. The MS, the guy wanted to become from. He was already living his life as what we would call a from guy, showing up at shul in Arizona. His wife, who he had married before he ever realized all this stuff, was basically agnostic. You know, she was somebody who grew up in a very traditional, you have to think also, the Latino community in the Southwest is very, very deeply religious. You know, it's not like, liberal people living in Boston.
Right.
This is real deep. I'll tell you what happened was, so Rabbi Goldberg, who's the rabbi there, brought this couple into his office, and the position, I don't know if it's a common position, is that, we said, we're not going to break up the family, they have two kids, we're not going to, if he wants to be Jewish, that's fine, but everybody's got to go along with him, his wife has to go along with him too, even though he seems like he's very committed.
She was brought up in a Jewish home?
She was brought up in a traditional Catholic home. Traditional Catholic home, like deeply, deeply religious, and because her husband's going through all these changes, she had kind of, become, floating for a couple of years. We brought her in, within a second, Rabbi Goldberg says, sir, do you still believe in Jesus? Literally, within a second, the tears start rolling down her eyes. You can see that it's not the type of thing where, if she says, I'm going to become Jewish, I'm going to become from, and all these things, it takes 1 second to smell it that it's not a step that she's ready for. It's not what you would expect from a Gare.
You can't expect people to answer honestly anyway.
Okay, but you can pull out what the truth is. And the second you literally just the word Jesus, and I'm telling you, I've never seen anything like it. It's like it's as if he was in the room looking over her shoulder. You know, it was like
Well, the question essentially gets down to how serious does the commitment to the mitzvahs have to be?
Correct. So that's ultimately, and that's what has to be handled on a case-by-case basis. That's ultimately what has to be handled on a case-by-case. It seems like Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is only dealing with somebody who would have a real commitment to mitzvahs, whereas Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is somebody who would give a little bit more leeway of somebody. And what's been spoken about, his position is that, you know, if there isn't as much commitment to mitzvahs, then, look, he still writes in full acceptance of mitzvahs or commitment to the Torah. So they don't leave a lot of room for leeway. They don't leave a lot of room for leeway. Rav Avadya Yosef was even more aggressive about this, and writes that, you know, there's no idea of a te'udas hashavim. He writes, they want to come back, they're welcome to come back, but, you know, you got to do things the right way. He actually got in a little bit of trouble because with Ethiopians, initially, his stance was not the same. And that there's a lot more to be written about that. You could give a whole shiur on just what Rav Avadya's stance was on each of the Jewish communities that returned to Israel in modern day, starting with, you know, the Ethiopians, with the Russians. He's had a lot to say about it. That's why specifically I didn't want to bring in his opinion, because it's so muddled. You know, where everybody else has one or two tshuvas, he's got like 15 tshuvas, and each one says something a little bit different. In each case, he's handled very publicly in a different fashion. So it's hard to kind of pen one opinion to him. But he's also been very outspoken on this, and in this case specifically, like Rav Mordechai, maybe even more aggressively than Rav Mordechai Eliyahu would say, it's not just a tshuvas hashavim, it's something that would require, you know, a real kabbalas hamitzvos and a real gerus process. So if you look, there's actually a legal document, the certificate of return, the Te'udas HaShavim, which is filled out for one of the Anusim who comes back and decides they want to be a member of Am Yisrael. That's source number 9. You don't have to go through it, but the idea is that, you know, if you look at the second paragraph, you get the idea. Badaknu v'dikam v'dubdeket et kavanat or kavanatah, meaning that we see what their kavanas are. What's the obvious place where this could go wrong? Somebody who wants to get married to a Jew shows up in the rabbi's office and says, oh yeah, I'm a Marano, I don't know if you know, and I don't have to get any conversion. So you have to figure out, like you would in any conversion situation, what the proper kavanos are. But you can see where this situation could be taken advantage of already. So that's the key phrases by Dr. Vadika Mizukdekia. Right? And then each case obviously has to be handled in a case-by-case situation, but the words of the Rashbash are always at the fore of mashkal b'chesed, to bring them back with chesed. And then if you look at the last page, not a halachic page, but just the article of how prevalent the Jewish community that left Spain is, you see, if you read this article, this is from 2004 from the Los Angeles Times, there was a DNA project that was done in St. Edward's Church in Albuquerque, and people came out of the woodworks to get these DNA tests done, and they found amongst the Latinos that were there, of the 78 people tested, 30 of them had the Kohanim gene, which is like, it's pretty amazing. Robert, you might have some new friends soon. Let's say somebody shows up in shul with the Kohen gene and says, well, not only am I Marano, I have the Kohen gene, right? Does it carry any weight halakhically? No, because we base our yichus, not the kahuna, we base yichus on the mother, not on the father. So practically this is, it's very nice, and you can show that somebody says, I had some Jewish blood in me, and I have the Kohen gene, and you have to learn really what the Kohen gene is from a DNA perspective, but from the standpoint of yichus,
there's a big difference between letting the guy dochen to give him a later and being an achasin.
Correct, and everybody reflects that. And all the tshuvas reflect.
Here, right?
Open them. Right? Okay, thanks. If the bracha works, great, and if it doesn't, no harm, no foul. Get to see what type of socks the guy wears. But practically, you know, we wouldn't do that just because, you know, you don't want to put somebody up as a Kohen in one standpoint and tell them he's not. I think it's kind of a... There's a lot more to be said about this, but if you look at the key quote here, he writes, "We believe a fairly high percentage of the first families arriving in New Mexico were nominally Catholic, but their secret religion was Judaism. And with the founding of the State of Israel over the last 60 years or so, that's the majority of the people who have come out and said, we are Anusim, we're Muranos, all came from the southwestern United States, and people who are like kind of on the Mexico-U.S. border in and around that area. And there's huge communities of Latinos that are there today, which very well could be members of the Jewish people, only, you know, very regrettably, there's no way to trace back somebody's ephes for 500 years and to say mother after mother after mother. Because of that, the people who want to come back to the fold of the Jewish people, very much we welcome them in, but from a halakhic standpoint, once they decide that they want to become a part of Am Yisrael from the standpoint of marriage, then obviously it's going to have to be whatever are the Geirus rites that go along with the rituals and rites that go along with the Geirus. So, yeah.
You said that those that claim they were colonial, they were more careful about marrying internationally.
So that's...
So those came and said, we were careful about our marriages, our family. We were colonial, we were trained with colonial, and therefore we're careful, and we know that we didn't have an international.
It's hard. Obviously, every situation has to be handled on a case-by-case basis, but it's not that the Jews of Spain had a preponderance of Kohanim amongst their people. It's that the ones that were Kohanim very probably were the ones who are more careful about Yivos. And so if you're more careful about Yivos, then you come back and you have 30 out of 78 of the Kohuna gene. It doesn't mean that you had such a high level of kahuna. It just means that of the Kohanim, those were the ones that were still lighting candles in the basement every Friday night. One interesting thing to note is that they were so afraid, they never told anyone in the family, whoever was the Balabayit, never told the members of the family about the true yichus until they were at least 40 years old. So what happens is when you move from place to place, not everybody makes it to 40. Especially, you know, they didn't have hospital systems like we do. You know, people are dying young, you end up losing whole generations of it, and people just over time peter out like that. Because even up to a couple hundred years ago, people were still fearful of the Inquisition. Yeah.
Is there any reason they moved into this area? Was it because it was separate from everybody else? It's like the type of, like if you're just a Murano, you don't want to be in a place where there are a lot of other people who just wanted to go out and stick somewhere?
It's possible. I don't know.
How far back to that?
How far back to what?
How far back does that community go?
What community is it?
Well, Jewish community in the Southwest.
I mean,
what I'm trying to get at is, it sounds to me like there's got to be some gap between the expulsion from the Iberian Peninsula.
Oh, yeah. So they're obviously
to show up here.
Initially, the places where they went, really, the real dispersion was after 1497, not after 1492. And the ones who left Portugal ultimately ended up in places like the big spots were Holland.
Brazil.
Holland was one. Well, all throughout South America. It didn't start off in Brazil. Places like, even like Curacao. Right?
Yeah.
That's like a huge Jewish community. And there's still a big shul there today. But they didn't get there until like 100 years later, you know? You don't just go straight. It wasn't like they took a plane and they showed up there.
But it sounds like you're saying that, it's not what he's saying, but this community was pretty homogeneous and kept itself together.
Right, it wasn't really that they ended up...
Very, very clearly.
So
when
does it wander back into Arizona?
I don't know the exact date, but it seems like it would have to be sometime around the 1700s. Because we know already that in the 1700s there were a lot of Jews living in Mexico. And I imagine that, there were, the U.S. wasn't... It wasn't like there was like a state line there and had to cross over the border. Things were, you know, you can't think of them in, you know, like Arizona and New Mexico, you know, what we call New Mexico then, there was no like, it was kind of one area where they were, it was like separated by the Rio Grande, but it was like...
You know, Mexico was 1840.
Yeah. So there's a big quote. It's a little, you know, obviously there's a lot of, you know, in a 1 hour shiur, there's obviously going to be a lot of historical, you know, hotspots that you can go into and find more information about, probably get more of the clues. But the fact that it's a halakhic problem today, after however many years since initially the Jews were expelled is really fascinating. And that's one of the things that happens with the advent of the State of Israel, is that instead of people wanting to not be Jews, now all of a sudden it's like the Jewish gravy train. Look, oh, there's something called the right of return. I want to get on that. I want to go be Jewish. So that's something that's really different now than it's ever been since, you know, the Beis HaMikdash. People actually want to be Jews who aren't Jewish. So, yeah.
There may be people who want to be Jews, but they maintain their belief in Jesus. I mean,
yeah.
It's a bigger school up to be a...
Yeah.
I could see, you know, evangelical Christians loving this duality of their existence.
Yeah, obviously it's okay. Jews for Jesus.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
We got the Rambam about the Kabbalah anyway, so it's animal for them. By the time the rabbi,